Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to the All 80s Movies Podcast, a podcast where we talk about the blockbusters, the flops, and everything in between from one of the freshest decades for movies, the 1980s. I'm your host, Bill Banton. Along with me on this journey revisiting 80s movies is my co-host, Jason Masick. Hello, Jason.
Dearly beloved, we have gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word life. It means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else. The afterworld.
That's right, listeners. We are discussing, with spoilers aplenty, the 1984 musical drama Purple Rain, produced by Purple Films and distributed by Warner Brothers. It stars Prince, Apollonia Cotero, Morris Day, and Clarence Williams III. Directed by Albert Magnoli, this movie is rated R with a running time of 1 hour and 51 minutes. The movie won one Oscar for Prince for Best Music Original Song Score. So, what is this movie about? What's on the box? If you grew up in the 1980s and went to your local video store to rent this movie, you would find this description on the back of the VHS box. It is... What's on the box? Take it away, Jason.
The urgent, explosive feature debut of Rock's Prince. Take a richly human story of survival and triumph, a now soundtrack by some of the hottest bands around, and the startling, brooding presence of 24-year-old rock superstar Prince, the man who lived the music. And you've got Purple Rain, which, according to Rolling Stone, may be the smartest, most spiritually ambitious rock and roll movie ever made. This is the passionate behind-the-scenes stuff that rock and roll dreams are made of. A pulsating slice of rock semi-autobiographical film starring Prince as The Kid, a Minneapolis club musician known for his lightning guitar riffs and flash fire vocals. As alienated as he is talented, the kid struggles with both a tumultuous home life and his own smoldering anger while taking refuge in his music and his steamy love for sultry Apollonia Cotero, lead singer of the Camisole chic Apollonia 6. This turbulent, gutsy film sizzles, seethes, and rocks in a way few rock films ever have. Hot-blooded Prince and his band The Revolution give electrifying performances of songs like the exhilarating Let's Go Crazy, I Would Die for You, the plaintive classic When Doves Cry, and of course, Purple Rain, and other hits from the best-selling Warner Brothers Records soundtrack album of the same name. Hailed by Newsweek as the new Prince of Hollywood, Prince and Purple Rain will reign over rockdom for some time to come. Purple Rain.
Purple Rain. So that was What's on the Box. Jason, how are we doing?
That was a mouthful. Oh my gosh. It's so funny. For a film that, I don't know, for all intents and purposes, somewhat straightforward, that was a long blurb, but I enjoyed it.
I know. I kept waiting to think you were going to finish. I'm like, wow, he keeps going. He keeps going.
But to answer your question, Bill Bant, I'm great. I'm fantastic. I can't wait to talk about this. I love Prince. And this was a fun rewatch. Spoiler alert. I should have said spoiler alert before I said fun rewatch. But how are you feeling, man? Are you ready to record this? Are you ready to get into some Prince?
Oh, very excited. So let's get into our earliest memories. What's your earliest memories of this film, Jason?
I do not have a lot regarding earliest memories when it comes to the actual viewing of this film. But as a fan of Prince in 1984, I definitely knew about the movie. Its presence was well known, but I did not come to watch it until much later. I'm sure I was shielded from this adult content in this film at the start, seeing as though I was only 10 years old when it was released. But I recall hearing about it through the grapevine. There were the rumblings through the playground that it had the nudity and the sex in it. And that it was just, I don't know, fine as a movie, that it was basically just Prince's music. Like, you can say that, really, just Prince's music. But again, admittedly, I did not have much interest in seeing it until much later. I was a big fan of Prince, and that was mainly because of the Purple Rain album. No question about it. I was familiar with the songs before the Purple Rain album, like 1999 and Little Red Corvette off the 1999 album, but the Purple Rain album was Prince through and through for me. That's what Prince is to me, and it had such an impact that it still is what I think of when I think of Prince. As aforementioned on this podcast, I was involved in dance until the age of 12. And when this album came out and the tracks were so often played on the radio, they were often also played during our dance practice. And I'm pretty sure we had some choreographed number to, you know, like the song Let's Go Crazy. But in regards to my early memories of the film, I'll always remember my dance teacher, Kim Calla, saying that she couldn't believe what Prince did to Apollonia in the movie, as if she were, and she was, really taken aback by a particular scene. And at first, because I had only heard about the sexuality of the movie, I thought she, like, Prince had done something violent or perverse sexually to Apollonia, but it would be much later that I realized she was referring to the physical abuse, spoiler alert here, when Prince's character, the kid, does slap Apollonia, no bueno. So I had no idea that one of the themes of this movie had anything to do with domestic abuse until I saw it much later. Another early memory is simply the fact that Prince and When Doves Cry was literally on the radio all the time, everywhere, all the time.
All the time.
Every station. You couldn't escape. Music video, the song on the radio, didn't matter. But well-deserved. I mean, it is an incredible song to this day. Because I didn't see the movie until years later, I never really thought of the album as a soundtrack to the film until now. I just loved all the songs. I was in love with the rock synth, of course, and without the images of the movie, I came up with my own images and interpretations in my mind because Prince's music evokes so much thought and feeling. I still love this image in my mind of having the 45 record of the song Purple Rain, which was actually purple, and putting it on the record player. And I'll just say this, Purple Rain, as we know, is a magical song, and it's meant to be played in its entirety because it has such a wonderful, extended, and powerful instrumental resolution and flourish of an ending. And man, it would piss me off to no end, and it still does, whenever a DJ plays it on the radio and cuts it short. And it's like that with a lot of songs. It's the same with the Def Leppard song, Hysteria. If you're going to play the song, play the whole song. The ending is really important. That's all I'm saying. It really grinds my gears. Just had to get that off my chest. If you're going to play Purple Rain, play the whole damn song. I thought Prince was the man. He was a huge pop star. He was a genius. He was an icon, synonymous with the 80s. But at first, man, I just dug his music. That's it. The vocals, the screams, the attitude. But the fact is, it took me some time to mature, to really understand the man that was Prince, the artist that was Prince, to appreciate what a complete talent he was, to realize he was a once-in-a-generation type of talent that could sing, dance, write prolifically, and play every single instrument as well. He was a phenom. In regards to the Purple Rain album, I also didn't understand until I matured that it had some mature content. I even remember a cousin of mine saying to me when I was young, "You know what Darling Nikki is really about, don't you?" And of course, I totally faked it. And I was like, yeah, sure, totally. Having no idea it was X-rated. Funny side note, I always got the actress Apollonia Cotero and the actress Vanity from Action Jackson totally mixed up. And it turns out, for good reason, as we may explain later. I'm glad I can say I did see Prince live in the early 2000s at Staples Center before it was Crypto.com Arena, and it was amazing. I mean, I went with a girl that I had a huge crush on and made some lame attempts to dance with her during some of the songs, but she wasn't having it. Wah, wah. So I was slightly upset and distracted by that, but I'll never forget Prince doing his acoustic version of Little Red Corvette. I mean, I can't say enough. The guy was unreal. It's just fun to watch someone who's clearly on another level and exists on a higher plane. An absolute entertainer who was in himself a gift that was shared with all of us. So those are some of my early memories of Prince as an artist, of this movie a little bit too. But I will hand it over to you, Bill Bandt. What are your earliest memories of Purple Rain?
Purple Rain, I didn't see it until the late 80s, and it was a rental. And I don't know why it took me so long to watch the movie. I was a huge fan of Prince, loved his music, had a couple of his albums. And like you said, the mid-80s, you couldn't listen to a radio station for 30 minutes without hearing one of his songs. So he was huge. But there was just something about the movie that just kind of made me hesitant to watch it. And then when I finally did, it was interesting to see how all the songs from the album, and like you said, technically the soundtrack, fit into this movie. And I thought that was kind of cool. It's like, oh, that's kind of neat how this all kind of, it does all tie in into the movie somehow. The big things I remember, just that motorcycle that he had was so cool. And then just the music itself. And you know, we're going to get into it too. Just, you know, starting off just with a back-to-back of Prince and Morris Day and the Time. Just like, man, what a 1-2 punch to start things off. That was really cool. I really enjoyed it. Funny, it's the only Prince movie that I have seen, just because all the other ones got panned so bad, I never bothered watching any of the other ones. But to this one, yeah, I just love his music and was just really interested in finally seeing the movie. And then when I did, it was one of those, why didn't I rent this sooner? I don't understand what the hesitation was. It was certainly a fun watch, and excited about getting back into talking about the movie all these years later.
Yeah, 100%. Right there with you, Bill Bant. I as well have not seen his other films, at least not in full. I may have seen a scene here or there.
Bits and pieces here or there.
I didn't have a connection to the music on those particular albums either that I did to this particular album. It wasn't that I didn't listen to those songs or hear those songs or appreciate them. It's just this particular album hit me in a certain way at a certain time. Thus, I had obviously more an investment in the film. Anyway, ready to get into some initial thoughts, man.
Go for it.
All right, we got to start with the one and only Prince. Just for those who don't know, Purple Rain was actually his sixth album. It's crazy. First, he released For You in 78, then the self-titled Prince in 79, then Dirty Mind in 80. He did Controversy in 81, 1999 in 82, released Purple Rain in 84, then Around the World in a Day in 85, Parade in 86, Sign of the Times in 87, Love Sexy in 88, and Batman in 89. The dude's got over 40 albums if you include the releases credited to Madhouse and the New Power Generation, the NPG Orchestra, as well as three albums released posthumously. Absolutely insane. After his passing in 2016 at the age of 57, and I'm taking this from Wikipedia, there's a vast array of unreleased material was left in a custom-built bank vault underneath his home, including fully completed albums and over 50 finished music videos. Estimates of the complete number of songs written by Prince range anywhere from 500 to well over 1,000, some of which were made popular after being covered by other musicians, most notably Nothing Compares to You by Sinead O'Connor and Manic Monday by the Bangles. Prince sold over 100 million records worldwide, ranking him among the best-selling music artists of all time. But let's look at his filmography, since this is a movie podcast. So, yeah, he portrays the character known as The Kid in this, Purple Rain in 84. Then the character Christopher Tracy in Under the Cherry Moon in 86. Then himself in Sign of the Times in 87. And then again, he reprises his role as The Kid in Graffiti Bridge in 1990. And then he plays himself once again in Three Chains of Gold in 1994. He was also in an episode of Muppets Tonight in 97. He played himself in an episode of New Girl in 2014. Guess what? He was also a director, directing his own music videos in the 80s, as well as the film Under the Cherry Moon, Sign of the Times. He also directed the movie Graffiti Bridge in 90, which, as I said, he reprised his role as The Kid because Graffiti Bridge was the unofficial sequel to Purple Rain, in which The Kid is now club owner and rival to Morris Day, with whom he gets into a fight for the Glam Slam nightclub. All right, I'm going to move on and talk about Albert Magnoli for a moment, our director of this film. Yes, he does Purple Rain in 84. He did some Prince music videos after that, of course, and he actually became Prince's manager for a bit. He directed American Anthem, that movie about the gymnast starring Mitch Gaylord and Janet Jones in 1986. Remember that one? He does more music videos, including some additional footage on Sign of the Times. And then at some point, he directed at least part of Tango and Cash, where he's uncredited because he actually replaced director Andrei Konchalovsky. And after that, he directed the Prince music videos of Scandalous and Bat Dance from the Batman movie. And after that, he directed a couple more films. And this last one's for our buddy Joe Quinn. He directed one episode of Nash Bridges in 1997. Yeah. All right, getting into the movie. God, man, Bill Bant, I'm watching this. I just am smiling, man, from ear to ear. I don't know if I said it out loud, but I sure thought it really loud. So that thought was simply, God, the 80s were great, weren't they? Man.
Oh, yeah.
God, the 80s were great. I love the fact that Prince is only known as the kid in this film. I mean, yeah, he's only 25 years old at the time it was shot, which is insane. And I guess, yeah, he's like the man with no name, but in the music scene of Minneapolis for this movie. So, by the way, the backdrop of Minneapolis is great. Those that know Prince know that's where he's from, where he grew up in that area. But it's great in this film. The cold, urban, gritty scenery, what seems like a blue-collar Midwestern city outside this hopping small club scene at the First Avenue Club. There's this obvious and stark contrast between the city backdrop and his humble home and the pomp and circumstance of Prince himself in the club. The club scene most definitely is providing this escape or almost dream world for the local residents. And of course, combine that with all the flash of Prince's outfits, the shoulder pad jackets, the leather pants and overall style down to his high heel shoes, his boots, the style of his guitar. And of course, his purple motorcycle, as Bill Bant mentioned. Wikipedia calls this a rock musical drama, which it most definitely is, as well as a blend with like a just a, being a club concert film. But I have to say, man, I love the fact that this feels like musical theater at times, like an actual musical with Prince or the kid riding his bike through the smoke-filled alleys and the choreographed musical acts and the music itself providing a lot of the narrative with just a bit of dialogue and straight narrative sprinkled in. I really like how the film's edited and shot for the most part. It looks fantastic. It's sexy. And it's an absolute showcase for what real talent looked like in the 80s. And unfortunately, that shines a spotlight on what the bad version of talent was like also with Apollonia Six's rendition of Sex Shooter, which was written by Prince also. And Des Dickerson with Modern Air, but we'll just talk about that later. Anywho, wanted to give some credit to Magnoli for the direction because it's a musical that turns music video during interludes like Take Me With You and When Doves Cry. And again, it just puts the power of Prince on full display, front and center. The songs and performances are weaved into the narrative pretty well, as Bill mentioned. And I literally can't wait. I can't wait in this movie until the kid gets back on stage to perform again. All the songs he performs are bangers. All the songs on the album, the soundtrack are bangers. From Let's Go Crazy to Baby I'm a Star. We get the sex, the flash, the moves, the vocal screams, the showmanship. It's all there on display, and I found it exhilarating, to be honest. It's all transporting me back to a magical time. Now, my initial thought here, you know, the narrative of the film, at times it works, at times it doesn't for me. That's all. There's some bad acting moments. There are some decent acting moments. You know, here's the setup for those of you that are not familiar with the film, the beautiful Apollonia. By the way, that's her real name. And yes, that's the character's name. And yes, she's beautiful. And she's rolled into town, into Minneapolis, inserting herself in the local club scene, looking for work as a singer and a dancer to become a star. We know that the kid, a.k.a. Prince, is the star frontman of a band called The Revolution that performs weekly at the First Avenue Club downtown and is somewhat in competition for a spot and notoriety with another band, which is Morris Day and The Time, that also performs at the club. We learn that the kid has a rough home life. His room is in the basement where he can work on his music, but he can't escape the cries of his mother as being physically abused by his father. Thus, we see the narrative unfold of the kid falling into a relationship with Apollonia, the kid and the revolution competing to keep their slot on stage at the club, and the kid battling his own demons and trying to process his anger and prevent his father's domestic abuse. Also to prevent himself becoming his father by becoming an abusive partner to Apollonia and to finally take ownership and allow the storytelling to flow through his music and to allow the collaborative efforts of his band to exist instead of trying so hard to control the whirlwind he exists within. It's great. It's all good. But one of my major thoughts is the film certainly doesn't portray women well at all. there's the misogyny, there's the physical abuse, and there's an understanding that the behavior is reprehensible, but we don't see the women in this either being defended or taking a stand or fighting for themselves or portraying a certain strength. We don't see the men paying the price for their actions either. Yes, the kid's father, spoiler alert, attempts to take his own life, but he survives and becomes sympathetic, question mark? I don't know. I'm not going to say the film promotes abuse in any way, but in my opinion, it doesn't do much to combat it either. Instead, it portrays both the kid and his father's tortured souls that are creatives at heart, but just don't know how to deal with their emotions. That might be true, but the actions are unacceptable. The way women are treated in this is exploitative and makes them appear weak. And the way the movie deals with the abuse aspect is a little rough, in my opinion. That's my opinion. It's not a great look. Again, just my opinion. So another thought is the movie's a little too long. I'd say if you choose to show a handful of entire performances on stage and music video vignettes in between, then great. Just do that. It could be an hour or an hour and a half musical / music video montage showcase. The narrative themes are fine. They're solid, but do it with even more minimalistic dialogue and truly make it an all show, don't tell sort of movie. Finally, overall, watching this as an adult, I thoroughly enjoyed this because of the music. Duh, the songs and musical performances are stellar. It looks fantastic. The choreographed routines are so fun. I will give some credit to the narrative because it does feel as if the culmination of the Purple Rain performance in the finale is emotionally effective. I got a little teary-eyed. I have to admit it. I'm a sap. I've said that before. I had a great time watching this again. What are your initial thoughts?
First thing, just based on what you said, I was surprised that you felt like the movie was too long. I felt the opposite. Like when I watched the first time, I'm like, holy shit, it's over already? And then I watched it again and I was like, damn, this movie's over already?
Awesome.
I think it flies. And I think a lot of it has to do with the musical performances. And anytime Prince is on stage or even Morris stays on stage, that guy was a genius. And would I even think about it? Because there's a scene in the movie when the manager talks about there being three acts. And I was like, I want to see who this third act is, because if you have Prince and you have Morris Day, I'm sure they would have had someone huge as the third act. I just wanted to see them perform a song and see what that was. So yes, the music is definitely the highlight of the movie. This is what's worth coming to see. I think the two biggest surprises I took away from watching this was Prince's character, the kid. He's a dick. I mean, he treats his band like crap. He acts like an asshole to Apollonia. And like you said, he does physically strike her at one point and just treats her like dirt, but she just follows around no matter what. And that was kind of hard to see. But then you understand the course of the movie, his father's like that too. So it's a father like son kind of thing. But he does recognize by the end of the movie that he needs to get away from that kind of a relationship. But I don't think he ever makes a full turn, to be honest. And then he plays the unsufferable genius. He doesn't listen to anyone else. And people are warning him if he follows down this path, it's going to lead to trouble. And he just doesn't care. All he cares about is being on stage and performing his music. And that's it. So, yeah, he's kind of a rough character. I was kind of surprised how rough he is in this movie, physically and just the character himself. The second biggest surprise was how funny I found this movie to be. Morris Day and Jerome, anytime they were on screen, those two cracked me up. And even the whole thing with when Morris Day is up there singing and Jerome brings out, I mean, that bit never gets old to me. I always love that. I mean, they do that today when Morris Day and the Time performs. It's hilarious. The dynamic of those two was hilarious. They do a little funny who's on first bit with a password, what, basically ripping that off. But just the two of them were hilarious. I thought Morris Day was the highlight of the movie. Spoiler alert, you come to find out he was basically high the whole movie or on cocaine. So yeah, he was running a mile a minute and it shows on screen, but it really does work. I was almost kind of like, why do these two not do more movies? They have screen presence. I mean, Prince has screen presence, but so do these guys. So the three of them, I thought they were just great. Apollonia, she's just stunning. But like you, and I was going to get into it with complaints. Yeah, that sex shooter thing. I was like, oof.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't have a problem with the song, but the choreography is wow. Overall, just the music stuff, even like in the opening, when Morris Day's doing Jungle Love and they cut it. And I was like, oh, no, finish the song. It's so catchy and fun. But yeah, I mean, they do a ton of songs in there. It works really well. Seeing the movie so long after listening to the soundtrack ad nauseum, it was really cool to see how it all fit into the film itself. And all of it works perfectly. So that's my initial thoughts of Purple Rain.
That's great, man. I think we'll have to agree to disagree on some of these points. But overall, I freaking love this movie. I can't get enough of the performances throughout. Morris Day and the Time are electric on stage, no question about it. I'll take Prince over anybody and any other performance any day of the week. But still, Morris Day and the Time are great. But I will disagree with you on the comedic talents of Morris Day and Jerome. I'm glad that you love them, but it did not work for me. I actually had that in my complaints, especially the Who's on First bit just fell flat for me. I thought Morris Day was very performative and almost caricature-ish in his comedy. And I kind of chalked that up to a little bit of that research you mentioned about him allegedly being high all the time. But hey, I get it. If that's your flavor, man, I'm not going to knock that. I'm glad you found them extremely entertaining and would love to see them as a duo in another film series, which I could see if it were refined a bit and Morris Day took a few more acting lessons, I think it could work. It just didn't quite work as well for me personally in this movie, but that's being a little nitpicky. It's not a big part of the movie. Hey, small things. I did want to get back to the point when you mentioned the three acts that perform at the club, the three slots. You may already be aware of this and may have not mentioned it, but the third slot is Des Dickerson and the Modern Heirs.
Right, who we never get to see him perform. Which
we
is
do,
kind of
actually. It's brief. He sings the song Modern Air.
Oh, okay.
It's a little cheesy. It's not memorable. I don't knock you for having forgotten it. It's brief. He's in the front. He's the front man. There's dancers behind him. And all he keeps saying is Modern Air, Modern Air, Modern Air. And it's a little weird.
God, but I don't remember that. Brief. That's terrible.
It's that short. But the thing is, I actually agree with you. Like, I thought the same thing. I had to go back in the research and go, who are the three acts? If there's three slots, why are they feeling like they need to fight for one of the spots or one of them might lose their spot? I was like, just kick out Des Dickerson. By the way, stepping on some trivia, Des Dickerson actually was a member of the Revolution before Wendy joined. And I'm going to get into that a little bit later. All right, man. Are we ready to keep it rocking?
Let's get into favorite scenes or moments. What are some of our favorite scenes and moments from Purple Rain?
Well, you know where a good place to start is, Bill Bant?
Usually in the beginning.
You nailed it. The beginning, ladies and gentlemen, the revolution. Hell yeah, man. We hear that voiceover in the beginning. We hear the cheers from the crowd. The synth, the organ comes in. And we hear, dearly beloved. And we know immediately the movie is kicking right off with Let's Go Crazy. The lights come up. We see the silhouetted, smoky, backlit image of Prince, a.k.a. The Kid, standing at the mic, holding his guitar and wearing his purple jacket. And there's some quick cuts of close-ups of the crowd. And the title Purple Rain comes up. And I'm like, oh, hell yeah, here we go. The beat kicks in. And then the dirty guitar riff. And if the elevator tries to bring it down, go crazy. The lights come up on the stage and we see the revolution rock out with synchronized moves. And it's blast off, man. We go right into a montage of sequences that take place earlier in this particular night while the song Let's Go Crazy plays in the background. So we're just off to the races and establishing our protagonists. We see a yellow cab come down and pull over on this downtown street of Minneapolis, and the gorgeous Apollonia's in the back seat looking nervous. She looks over to see how much the fare is, how much that cab fare is, and decides, well, she's going to ditch the cab driver without paying, and the driver gives chase. Now it cuts to Morris Day and his red wife beater and boxers vacuuming his apartment or his home, I'm not sure which. But he's got this white headband on. He's picking out his fancy suit for the night. And then we see the kid getting ready in his dressing room and has got his guitar around his... Man, he just looks great. Prince is the man. He's about to go on stage. Then it cuts back to Apollonia escaping the cab driver as she looks to see how much cash she has left and spots a cheap hotel across the street. Then we see the line forming outside the First Street Club as the kid rolls up on his purple Honda CM400 Honda-matic motorcycle. And all of this is intercut with this performance of the kid in the Revolution performing the hell out of Let's Go Crazy on stage. Man, the kid's rocking out on the guitar, gyrating and moving only as Prince can move, gliding about the stage. Apollonia, well, she's paying for her room at the not-so-nice hotel. Morris Day is all dressed up for a night out and jumps into a car waiting for him, being driven by his friend and partner Jerome. Apollonia sees the action at the First Street Club across the street from her hotel room. Morris Day arrives at the club to the cheers of the crowd waiting outside. Prince is dancing on top of the piano, and cut back to a fun moment outside when Morris Day arrives. And does they do that bit? I think, Bill, you were talking about this with Jerome holding up a mirror for Morris to check his look. Yep. And he's brushing his hair. Man, it's just great. It's just great. Like that's great. Like that's their signature thing, right? And then Morris is now inside, and Apollonia managed to go across the street to the club, and she sneaks by the bouncer. Now she's inside. She manages to bump into a cocktail waitress and asks to see a manager about getting a job as a singer dancer. Then she takes notice of Prince up there on the stage and becomes entranced with his incredible guitar work during the final flourish of Let's Go Crazy. And you can tell things are going to get hot. Apollonia fills out an index card with her info on it, where she's staying and what she wants to be. She wants to be this performer. And it gets pinned to a corkboard with a ton of other index cards on it. And then Let's Go Crazy finishes, like I said, with a flourish. And we hear that announcer again, who's just so deadpan. It's great. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome The Time. And it's funny because, yeah, man, The Time, they're great. They get up and they're performing Jungle Love. And we watch Apollonia also enjoying Morris Day and The Time's performance. But I mean, come on, the Revolution blows everybody out of the water. That's just my opinion. Then the kid, he comes out because he's just finished his performance with the Revolution. He comes down into the crowd, is quite taken with the appearance of Apollonia. She's gorgeous. And he simply walks around behind her and just stands there, making her feel his presence, which is pretty damn hot, actually. And she finally gets up the courage to say, "I really liked your song, too." She turns around, but the kid has already disappeared into the night. Man, it's just a hell of a way to start a movie, to start this musical. You introduce the characters. But once the song Let's Go Crazy begins, there is so much electric energy behind it. You want to jump out of your seat and start dancing or rocking out and lip syncing and or just singing out loud because you can't help but move to it. It's like being shot out of a cannon. That's all I can say. It's a hell of a way to start. We know who our main players are going to be, and it's hot. It's exciting.
Yeah, what I thought was interesting about the opening, besides the fact that, you know, we get to see Prince perform right away and then we get to see Morris Day, is did you meet all our characters, but we don't know who anybody is until the girl at the club reads off Apollonia's name. So you don't know anybody's name. You just know, okay, these are probably all the main people that we're dealing with. And it almost sets it up that Apollonia is going to be the main character of this movie, which she's not, but it is your tale of girl comes to the city to try to make it big, and she's already taken aback by the two main acts at the First Avenue Club. And then she meets Prince, which I initially thought when I watched it that Prince was the manager of the club, that he was performing and managing, but you realize that is not the case. A lot going on, but it is great opening, especially just hearing the announcement of the announcer. Like you said, it's so dry, and it's over, I think it's over the Warner Brothers logo where you just hear, yeah, ladies, yep, and gentlemen, the Revolution. We're not taking any time. We're getting right into it. Love it.
Hell yeah, man. It's awesome. What's your first favorite scene, my friend?
Well, that was my first favorite scene also, but another scene that I really enjoyed, like I said, I really liked Morris Day and Jerome. I found them funny. And over the course of the movie, we do kind of have this love triangle where both Morris Day and the kid are trying to win the affection of Apollonia, and Apollonia's trying to judge love over career because she kind of wants to make it big as a singer, but she kind of has a thing for kid. And Morris is kind of telling her the kid doesn't take care of anybody. He only takes care of himself. Maybe if you come with me and we can talk, maybe I can help you out. So, of course, kind of makes her lean that way a little bit. And she goes to the club to watch the kid perform. And Jerome is told if he sees Apollonia in the club to go get Morris so they can sit down and talk. I thought it was kind of a funny scene. So Apollonia is sitting at a table. Jerome brings Morris over and introduces him to her. And he sits down and he calls the waitress over and goes, get your best bottle of champagne. And Apollonia kind of does the eyebrow raise that she's impressed. Like, okay, this guy's kind of going all out. And oh my God, he just throws this funny one-liner out. Like, your lips would make a lollipop too happy. And
yeah.
And at that point, the waitress comes over with the champagne and she obviously knows Morris because she goes, and who's paying for this? Meaning that he probably doesn't have the money to pay for it. And he's trying to play it off. Like, I can take care of this. I have it. And it might be a 50, it might be 100 because Apollonia is kind of impressed that he has some big bills. And she walks off and he screams out, keep the change. And right after she leaves, she calls Jerome over and whispers a little too loud, please make sure you go get my change. And then they go to sit down and talk. And Morris puts it out there and he's a little over the top because he goes, oh, Lord, someone must put something in my drink or you're the finest motherfucker I've seen in ages.
Yeah.
And Apollonia just does a, what? What did you say? And Morris tries to play it off with, you look nice tonight. And then at that point, Morris just puts his cards on the table. And when he's about to talk to Apollonia, we see the kid walk by and the kid sees that Morris and Apollonia are talking. And he kind of makes a smirk and makes his way to the stage. And then Morris talks about, oh, I wish you could come and see my house. I have an Italian cook. And he makes some kind of fake Italian name and to try to make her laugh. And he's like, you should see my bedroom. And I have this brass water bed. And he's putting the full court press. And at that point, we hear the introduction to the revolution. And we see the kid on stage. And he starts singing The Beautiful Ones. And the Beautiful Ones song is about a love triangle. And he's singing, do you want me or do you want him? And he's really singing it to Apollonia. And Apollonia, of course, catches on this right away. And the song's going and it's getting really intense. And he's playing the piano in the beginning. And then he gets up and he walks over the stage. And he's now just like looking at Apollonia and pointing at Apollonia. And then we cut to Apollonia. And she's in the stands and there's just like this slow pan that's going towards her. And you can see on her face, she's starting to get teary eyed. And you see Morris there sitting at the table, just kind of looking just like, damn it, this isn't going to work. And then it cuts away to Prince performing the rest of the song. And then we go back to Apollonia and it's kind of a close up. And you can see the kid has won. He's won her over with this song. And then the song finishes. And that's the only song that the revolution plays that night. They walk off stage after the song. And of course, the manager is upset about it. And then the kid meets up with Apollonia after the show in the back alley. And the kid tells her to get on her bike. And she kind of doesn't want to, but he's just get on. And then they drive off. So the kid wins the first round.
Oh, man, I love it. I almost chose this as one of my favorite scenes as well, Bill Band. And you can't compete. You're not going to compete with the kid in this scene. No way in hell. The kid, like you said, wins this round. That song, The Beautiful Ones, when he gets up from the piano and gets to the mic and starts wailing, like his voice, and he does his quintessential screaming, baby, baby, I want you.
Yep.
And then he falls to the ground and just is lying on his back. I mean, it's just so, it's all performance.
Yeah. Do you want me or do you want him? Because I want you.
Yeah. I mean, and you see the look on her face and it's, yeah, she's all about the kid in that moment. So it's great. You know what? You're kind of selling me on the comedy here, man, because that is funny. That's a funny scene. Morris Day is funny in that scene. There's some great lines and he is got some comedic timing there and some nice delivery. So you're swaying me over to your side when it comes to the comedy in this film regarding him and possibly Jerome. However, yeah, after the kid gets off the stage and goes into the back alley, it's great that there's a little moment where she's there waiting for him and he knows it. He knows she's going to be there. So cocky, so confident. Yes. and doesn't even look at her and just tells her to get on the bike. It's just great. It's like, oh, damn. He's like owning it, owning that moment. And she is under his spell. She's really just completely taken with him. So I'm glad you called out that because I was so tempted to put that one down. So
I know, just watching that scene and just watching her reaction, I was like, damn it, I should have took up music.
Right. That's the thing, man. You're just watching this guy perform. And it made me think about my relationship to him as a performer, because I was dancing at this time in the early mid 80s. And I wish I had more of an appreciation, not just for his music, but just for the way he moved on stage and how alluring he was. But I was a little too young to understand so much that went into his performance and all the thought and feeling he was exuding on the stage. Because so much goes into it. He's doing so many things on so many different levels all at the same time and nailing it. It's totally unique. So good stuff, man.
He's definitely not a standstill performer. He's all over that stage.
He's such a great dancer when he's falling. You know, I'm jumping around, but there's so many different performances when he's doing things with his body. He has such control over his body and his voice and his like all instruments. Pretty impressive.
Yeah. I always love how he uses the microphone stand all the time too. Yeah, and does right? The push out, kicks it back to himself. Damn, that's always cool.
He's the ultimate frontman, showman, whatever you want to say it.
Oh, yeah.
Right on, man. I'm going to move on to my next favorite scene here, and it's When Doves Cry. I'm biased. I'm nostalgic. I don't even know if it's really a great scene. It's just the music video. It's just an awesome fucking kick-ass song. it's When Doves Cry.
Yep, that's all you need.
That's all I'm going to say. Like, no, I'm going to say a little bit more. It's basically the music video. It's a montage. It opens with the street scenes. Now, I should say leading up to the scene, there's been some tumultuous activity within the narrative here. We know that there is domestic abuse at the kid's household. His parents, his father, played by Clarence Williams III, Clarence is beating on his wife. It's not good. And Prince is trying to fend off his father and get him off of his mother. And he's in tears. Everybody's in tears. It's not a good situation. And even the kid himself gets slapped around a little bit. Then, unfortunately, this also channels through himself as he gets into a little bit of an argument discussion with Apollonia when she tells him she's forming this band with the help of Morris Day. He gets angered and jealous and slaps her, and he's channeling his father, and not good. So a lot of emotions and such, and obviously that relationship is on the rocks now. So he's dealing with a lot also at the club, at the First Street Club. I am saying that right. Is it First Avenue or is it First Street?
First Avenue.
I keep saying First Street. I apologize, ladies and gentlemen. And there's some competition going on between Morris Day and Prince. And Prince is having some issues with the owner. The owner's like, hey, man, you got to clean up your act and make songs that make sense to people. Instead of just getting up there and saying whatever you're thinking or whatever it might be, gyrating around, you might lose your spot. So a lot going on leading up to this montage, this music video, When Doves Cry. We see street scenes of Minneapolis and a lot of the kid cruising around on his Honda-matic, his purple Honda-matic. And it's just great watching Prince cruise around. He's riding his bike and it's him. It's him on his bike. He's doing his own stunts, so to speak. He's riding the motorcycle. And he's going for a ride to have a think, if you will. We cut to shots of Apollonia and the kid making love in a barn on a bed. And then we see Apollonia is now rehearsing for his show now that she's part of this new girl group called Apollonia 6. We revisit the scenes of abuse at home between the parents of the kid and the kid himself losing his temper and hitting Apollonia. The kid continues to ride through different settings and he does like these hero poses. It's just Prince looking like a badass. That's all. Just looking really cool. And there's more flashbacks of great times with Apollonia. All with just one of the greatest tunes of all time. Doves Cry in the background. So the kid continues to ride through the different settings. He returns home to see his mother now sitting outside. This is like a block or so down from his house, and his mother's sitting outside crying, and he knows what's happened. His father most likely has been hitting on her again, and I don't mean flirting with her. He storms into his house, yelling for his dad. He's out for blood. He's just out for blood, yelling, where are you at? Where are you, motherfucker? He's looking all around the house, can't find his father. And then he looks to see the door to the basement is slightly ajar. And he goes downstairs into his own bedroom, and he finds his father sitting at the piano, playing a beautiful ballad, a sad ballad on this piano. And there's an allusion to the fact that his father was once an artist, but didn't follow through with it. And we get some dialogue here that's pretty bittersweet between the kid and his dad, because the dad stops playing and he turns around. We see that he is in tears, and it seems as though he knows that he is at fault, or he knows the error of his ways and the way he's been treating his wife, the kid's mother. And there's just a moment that follows. Would you agree here, Bill Bandt?
You know, it really starts off with Prince being so upset that he wants to take it out on his dad. And then when he goes down and hears him playing the music, he's taken aback by what his dad's performing. And he's trying to make some peace by asking him about the music. And he's like, is that your piece of work? He's like, yeah. He's like, oh, can I read the sheet music to it? And basically his dad comes back. It's all in my head. That's the difference between me and you. And then there's kind of a pause. It's like that awkward moment. And the father comes back with, you got a girlfriend. And the kid seems kind of taken aback and almost a little shy about it, but responds, yeah, I got a girlfriend. And the father says, you going to get married? The kid replies, I don't know. But then the dad comes back with a banger and just goes, never get married. And at that point, you could just see like tears flowing down the father's face. And whoa, that's a tough line. And of course, the kid's taken aback by it too, because if his father never gets married, he's not brought into existence. So that's kind of a hard thing to hear, I'm sure, from a parent to say, never get married, because then you're like, wait, am I part of a mistake here? Mm-hmm. And then the father goes upstairs in the hallway and then prints down the basement. And then he hears the gunshot and then goes up and sees his father try to take his own life, shoot himself in the head. So it's a tough one.
An emotional moment. You see some connection here. The writing is solid. It's a tough watch, but it's an impactful moment, and it makes sense in a very sad way. The father hates his life. He hates who he is. He hates his life, and he's bitter. And like you said, the kid can read it all over his dad's face. And what does that say about him or his existence? And it's that existential moment. It's tough.
Yeah, and it's tough too, because the father's played by Clarence Williams III.
Yeah.
And every time he's on screen, he's either angry or abusive, except for two moments when he's playing the piano. And then there's this scene when the kid brings Apollonia home and they look through a window into the house and see the kid's mother and father. They're not given names. So kind of being playful with one another, which is such a stark contrast from every other scene you see with the two of them together. It's never good. Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to then move into my final favorite scene, if that's all right.
Go for it.
To no one's surprise, it's the finale. It's Purple Rain. And the entire sequence does start pretty much after the kid's father attempts suicide, as Bill just mentioned. Now, the EMTs, the medics have shown up and they've taken the father away, and the kid is in the basement alone and he's losing his freaking mind because of what's just happened, understandably. And he's thinking about the possibility of, he's like, who, you know, he's again having this existential moment where it's like, who am I? What am I going to become? Am I becoming my father? And he keeps looking at this rope that happens to be on the ground next to, like, it seems where his father, not maybe where his father attempted suicide, but he's having all these flashes of his father attempting suicide. And also then he sees himself hanging by the noose. And is that going to be his destiny then? Is he really going to follow in his father's footsteps all the way to his own end? And we see him go into a fit of rage. He starts busting up his bedroom. I don't know what he picks up. He picks up a stick of some sort, and he's busting up all these jars on shelves, breaking all kinds of items. And he finally calms down, and he finds all of his father's songs. Basically, what's pretty much a treasure chest. It's a chest that's opened, and it's all of these songs that, as it turns out, are actually written out. So his father lied. He didn't have them all in his head. He actually wrote them all out. So he sees all of these songs written down. And one of the through lines of this film is that Wendy and Lisa, the guitarist and keyboardist of the Revolution, have been working on their own song independently and want to incorporate it into the show and have the band play it and have the kid sing it. And the kid has been selfish and doesn't want to sing or work on anybody else's music, just his own, and has been reluctant. He's been toying with, he's been playing the cassette that has kind of the temp track that Wendy and Lisa have laid down, but he hasn't followed through with working on any kind of arrangement. But at this moment, when he sees all of his father's songs, it seems as though he has an epiphany and something comes to him, and he puts in the cassette once again with that temp track of Wendy and Lisa's composition of what is to become Purple Rain. And the kid starts playing something on the piano. He starts making his own arrangement to the song. Then we cut to First Avenue Club, where Morris and the Time are performing The Bird, which is fun. That's a fun one. It's got a beat. And it's intercut with these shots of the band, the Revolution, backstage, waiting in their dressing room. And they're silent. They're quiet. Because Wendy and Lisa have not been pleased with the kid and his self-centeredness and not wanting to work on their song. And so there's this division within the band. They might lose their slot performing at the First Avenue Club. So not great time for them. And they're just waiting to go on stage. And meanwhile, now, when Morris and the Time are finished performing their song, they go backstage and they go by the dressing room to see the Revolution waiting in there with the kid. And they're mocking the song Let's Go Crazy by squealing the lyrics. And then there's this terrible moment when the Time, the band, moves along down the hall backstage. And Morris decides to lean into the dressing room and look at the kid and say, "How's the family?" in reference to the kid's father having just attempted suicide. It's pretty awful. Well, the Revolution manages to gather up and go on stage. And now we see Prince covered in a purple hue. And the crowd is quiet, awaiting to see what the Revolution's performance is going to be about this time. And the kid walks up to the mic and he takes his time and he clears his throat and he finally says, "I'd like to dedicate this to my father, Francis L. It's a song the girls in the band wrote, Lisa and Wendy." And we see Wendy's face and she is surprised to know that they are about to perform her and Lisa's song. And we get Purple Rain, and it's just the best. This is my favorite Prince song of all time. It's an anthem for me. It's an epic song, and it's wonderful because most of this scene is just, it's a, like a medium shot on Prince singing the song, and it's all in this purple light, and it's a beautiful thing. Just you watch him sing it and you are taken away. And then finally we see shots of the crowd and they are completely in a trance. They're totally mesmerized. We get shots of the owner, Billy, and we can tell, even though he's got his glasses on, that he's moved by the performance. And when it gets toward the end of the song, which is my favorite part, it's after the lyrics are even finished. It's after that. It's this just epic ending to the song. When Prince looks over to Wendy, and it's this wonderful moment when she's just in tears looking at him, he goes over and kisses her on the cheek. It's like, oh, man, we're back. They're back. And it's this tremendous flourish at the end with the crowd swaying their arms back and forth in the air. And you just get those final two notes of the song and the music fades out. And the kid goes running off the stage and out the back outside as if he's just going to take off on his Honda-matic and make a run for it. He's done. But he can hear the cheers of the crowd inside the club, and he turns around and he sees the cocktail waitress there, and she's just like, hi. He knows all of a sudden now all is right with the world. He goes back into the club, walking backstage, and there's just people lined there telling him what a fantastic song it was and fantastic job they did. And he gets back on the stage and they just keep rocking out to a couple more. Oh, I Would Die for You and Baby, I'm a Star. So it's just this whole final concert at the end, starting with Purple Rain. It just has a real emotional impact. Everybody's in tears. Before he goes back onto stage to perform I Would Die for You and Baby I'm a Star, he does have his kiss with Apollonia, who is also in tears. Everybody is in tears, like moved by this song that he is dedicated to his father. So that's it, the end. And it moved me to tears. Like, I was almost in tears because I adore this song. And I can't wait for him to just hit those final two notes at the very end. It's operatic for me. It's really impactful. So that's what I got for my last final scene or favorite scene.
It's a great ending because we're seeing Prince perform and it is one of his most iconic songs, The Purple Rain. Just on a side note, with the Morris Day, when he goes by and says the how's your family line and everyone kind of laughs and you can see the revolution is like, oh, what a fucking dick. And they all walk down the hall and Morris does stop.
Right.
And realize what he said is wrong while the rest of the band walks by. And then he kind of contemplates and you almost feel like he might go back and apologize, but he doesn't. But you can tell that he realized he did a shit move and he kind of felt bad about it.
I'm glad you called that out. It's a good call. They do put that scene is there, or that moment is in there on purpose. And yeah, you can tell he regrets saying it.
But yeah, you get three Prince songs at the end. So what a great way to end the movie.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Like I said, the highlights. And anytime you see any of the musical acts on stage, well, the main two, it's a win-win.
100%.
All right, let's move on to Swiss cheese and complaints. And why do we call it Swiss cheese?
Because although this movie is delicious, it does have Wendy and Lisa's cassette holes.
Yes, and if it does not have their cassette holes in it, we just file a complaint with the complaints department. So what do we have for Swiss cheese and complaints?
I'm just going to start with that overall complaint I had from the beginning. It's the treatment of the women in this. It's tough. It is part of the narrative. You know, I mentioned the abuse. I won't go into that anymore. But there is the scene near the beginning where Morris Day and Jerome are walking down the street and they run into this woman scorned, a woman that Morris clearly did wrong somehow. And Jerome literally picks her up and throws her into a garbage dumpster. That's not good.
It's bad yet funny.
There is something funny about it that Jerome just literally picks her up and heaves her into this dumpster. But it's like, okay, not great.
But a little trivia. Supposedly that's based on a true story.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah. The director overheard. And I don't know who told the story, so I don't know if this really happened with Morris Day, to be honest. But he heard about that story, and that's why they put it in the movie.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah. So the true story isn't Morris Day actually doing it. He had heard a story about somebody.
Correct. He heard it on the set, and they put it in. I guess Morris is the one that's who happens to in the script. So that, in a way, that even makes it worse that actually happened to someone.
Yeah.
I laugh because it's over the top, but at the same time, you're like, oh, that's so wrong.
Right. It's one of those things.
Yeah,
it is. It's a tough one, but you go back and forth on it. And I was just going to bring up one other scene. And you alluded to this earlier, Bill Bant. It's the scene by the lake when the kid and Apollonia are just getting to know one another. He takes her down to this lake and basically tells her part of the initiation, if she wants to become the star or whatnot, is to jump into the lake. And so she disrobes. We get our 80s boobs and she looks fantastic.
Yes, she does.
And then she jumps right into the lake very boldly. Credit to Apollonia. And then he pulls a high school prank, like the high school bully prank. This is what we did as boys in school where we treated girls like crap so they would like us. Like it's such a like a immature move. Gets on his bike and takes off when she's half naked and freezing. And then she puts her clothes back on, but he comes back on his bike to get her. And then when she tries to get on the bike, he keeps pulling away. not allowing her to get on the bike. And like, I used to do that, kind of funny, but it's so like sophomoric. And
yes,
but the point is, and you, this is what you said earlier, Bill, is that she likes him for it. Like, she's still attracted to him, and tell him, instead of saying, "Hey man, guess what? Fuck off. I don't play these child's games." She's totally into him. And it's like, ah, this is not setting a good example here.
No, not at all.
That all just ties into my overall complaint about the treatment of women and kind of how they're portrayed in this. But we'll move on from that, unless you have anything else to say.
No, not on that matter. Okay. We do have Morris Day drop a bad gay slur.
Yeah.
So just be prepared for that one. Yeah, this was a complaint. So what was the story with the girl that worked at the club? I think her name was Jill. And we meet her in the very beginning because she's the one that gets Apollonia's information.
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of comes in throughout. And I must feel like she had more importance, but it must have all ended up on the editing room floor. Because I almost even feel like in that opening when we meet Apollonia and Jill has the card and she's like, "Apollonia?" And Prince shows up and he looks at Apollonia and then he kind of looks at Jill. And back at Apollonia, I was like, "Is Jill like flirt with the kid all the time or something?" Because even at the end, after he plays Purple Rain and she's there in the back alley and says hi, like in a flirty kind of tone, I actually want to know a little more about Jill.
That's a great point, and I totally agree. There must have been something left on the cutting room floor regarding her story, because did the kid and her have a previous relationship? Did she herself want to become a singer and dancer? Thus, kind of when Apollonia first shows up, sees a little bit of herself in Apollonia, or like, here's another one, just another, you know, dime a dozen. They keep coming in. I was a girl like that once before, and here she's going to fall in love with Prince too, or the kid. I don't know. But clearly there was more to her character that we didn't see.
Yeah, I don't know. For some reason, she seemed interesting to me.
I agree. She had a great look.
Yeah, because she's the one that even has the cassette tape and gives it to Prince and say, "Hey, this is from Wendy and Lisa. I'd listen to it. It's really good. You should give it a shot." He kind of blows her off, but
maybe that's just it, is that she's worked at the club for some time and has a really great taste in music.
Right.
And maybe the kid listens to her opinion when it comes to giving maybe critique or constructive criticism on his music or performance or something like that. But yeah, we could have used a little bit more from Jill.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great point. I like it.
What else do you have?
All right. I will jump to this right away. Apollonia 6.
Ugh, yeah, mine too.
It's an unfortunate song. Sex Shooter.
I like the song.
Oh, no, really?
Wait, you have a song called Sex Shooter and you're doing ABC choreography. I'm like, you got to sell that song.
I agree.
No, Sex Shooter is a typical Prince kind of, most of his songs are about sex and stuff. So I'm like, no, that works.
All right. Agree to disagree.
I
didn't
have a problem with the song. I just thought the performance was terrible. I'm like, you have three attractive women up on stage and they're
in lingerie, just kind of
robotic.
Yeah. Oh, completely. The choreography is not great. I didn't like the song, but regardless, it just doesn't pop and it doesn't compare to any of the other performances. And I'll throw in Des Dickerson and the Modern Heirs as well. It's so brief that Bill doesn't even remember.
Yeah, I don't remember being in there.
So obviously very forgettable. So yeah, I'm going to put those together. Those Apollonia 6 and the Modern Heirs don't belong. It's kind of like you watch it, it's like, which of these don't belong? So that's a complaint.
Yeah, I would say for me, my final complaint, I think I just found this funny because, you know, the gist of the story is, we have the time, the revolution, and I'm just going to say group three. And here's Morris trying to bring in Apollonia 6 to bump out the revolution. And Billy's like, "Well, yeah, they're not bringing in the numbers." And then you watch the scenes of them performing. I was like, yeah, right. The revolution's so blowing everyone away.
So glad you're bringing this up.
How can you make it sound like that the revolution's on their way out?
They blow everybody out of the water. The revolution slays everybody. Like, there's no, it's not even close. They're unreal. They're unbelievable.
Yeah.
Can you imagine being in a club and seeing that performance, seeing that show?
Oh.
Even if you were not a fan of that genre of music, you would watch that and go, holy shit, these are amazing musicians and they've got some otherworldly energy because the performance is out of this world.
Yes, it's amazing stage presence.
I'm watching it going, I can't imagine playing that music with that high energy and the choreography trying and to hit all the beats, to hit all the dance steps along with playing the instruments and singing the songs all at the same time. Pretty awesome. I mean, look, we see a lot of musical artists do this, and they're very talented, but there's something special about this for me.
Yeah. And then even stepping on the trivia, when the Revolution's on stage and they supposedly bomb with the one song, which I think mm-hmm. is Darling Nikki, they right. had to cut around the audience because the audience was so into the performance.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they can do no wrong. So they had to cut
that's
around
their and make bad it sound like, song.
Right. Which, so they had to make it sound like it was seem like it was their bad song.
Yeah, because like Jill or the owner, they're offended yes. by the lyrics or the sexual innuendos.
But yeah,
at one point, Wendy is like almost like going down on the kid. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's funny because they just rock. I mean, they just rock the house. There's no way anybody would be like, yeah, numbers aren't good. People aren't enjoying your music. You could do better. No. Yeah. No, you're not going to do better than Prince and the Revolution.
No, you're not.
Yeah, you know, the other thing, and this is super nitpicky, it was just a little confusing, but this is kind of the just go with it aspect of the movie, the suspension of disbelief, meaning that the songs really work in the narrative, which is really cool. We both agree on that wholeheartedly.
Correct.
But you have to go with the fact that it is pretty convenient when Apollonia walks in and he has just the right song to sing in that moment under those circumstances directly to her.
Right. And the rest of the band knows exactly where to come in.
Thank you. Thank you. It's like, oh, we're going to sing Darling Nikki now because this is because he's angry and jealous and he just wants to make her feel like shit. Or at the end, when he's singing Purple Rain, which is just unreal and incredible, he's like, I'm dedicating this to my father. This is something that Wendy and Lisa wrote. Well, they're not prepared to play this arrangement.
Right. They know the music, but the other three members of the band have no clue.
Right.
For Dr. Funk, he has no idea.
It's kind of like this is like the example. You'll see this as a trope in movies when it's, for instance, Michael J. Fox playing Johnny B. Goode in Back to the Future when he gets up and he turns to the band and he's like, play this. We're going to start with this chord or that chord. And then the band just kind of has to improv and go along with it. It's like, oh, we're going to sing this song I dedicated to my father. And the other members of the band are like, okay, I guess we'll just kind of go with it. And it ends up being one of the best ballads of all time performed live.
Yeah. So when they do The Beautiful Ones, Darling Nikki and Purple Rain. Yeah. It's all off the cuff.
Mm-hmm. And they nail it.
I mean, that's musical genius right there. They really could do it that way. Just like, I got the lyrics in my head. Just follow me, guys.
And the thing is, you could almost buy it because they are that good.
Yes.
They are actually that good. But that's all I got, man, for my complaints.
All right, let's move on then to, hey, it's an actor.
All right.
So in this segment, we spotlight a character actor you have seen in many other films, an actor making their big screen debut, or an actor that makes an uncredited cameo. It's, hey, it's an actor. Who do we choose this week? This is kind of a toughie.
It was tough, but I'll tell you what, Bill Bant, it's a special episode because for this week's Hey, It's That Actor, we're going with Hey, It's That Actors, plural. I'm going with a duo. I'm going with Wendy Melvin and Lisa Coleman, also known as the duo Wendy and Lisa, band members of The Revolution. I'm going to put a little spotlight on our lovely ladies of Purple Rain, the film. If you look at their individual filmographies on IMDb, you will see they obviously were performers in the numerous music videos. Now, The Revolution, the band, performed together as Prince's live backup band at the end of the 70s and then his studio band in the early 80s up until 1986. And The Revolution had Lisa Coleman as the keyboardist, but guitarist Wendy Melvin wouldn't join the band until 1983, having been longtime friends with Lisa and then replacing Des Dickerson as an official member of The Revolution. After The Revolution was disbanded in 1986, This pair of talented women became known simply as Wendy and Lisa. So in 1987, the duo released an album simply titled Wendy and Lisa with Columbia Records in the U.S. And then they released 5 studio albums, with their most recent album being 2008's White Flags of Winter Chimneys. But what's also pure awesomeness is that Wendy and Lisa wrote a ton of TV and film music. Their first scoring project was for the film Dangerous Minds in 1995. Anyone know that? Yeah, little Michelle Pfeiffer. The team, Wendy and Lisa, has scored numerous TV shows and films, including popular TV shows like Crossing Jordan, Heroes, Nurse Jackie, and Firefly Lane. Wendy and Lisa technically share the honor of winners of a Grammy and Oscar for being part of the revolution, as Purple Rain won 2 Grammys and the Oscar for Best Original Score. In 2010, they received the Emmy Award for Outstanding Original Main Title Theme Music for their work on Nurse Jackie. They received the ASCAP Award for Composers of the Year for their work on Dangerous Minds, the theme to HBO's Carnival, Crossing Jordan, and Heroes. They were nominated for an Emmy in 2012 for the main title theme for the Fox show Touch. Both Wendy and Lisa are still with us today, doing their thing. Wendy is 59 and Lisa is 63 years old. Showing some love to Wendy and Lisa of the Revolution. Those are our Hey, It's That Actors this week.
I only knew about Dangerous Minds. Everything else was all new information for me. Appreciate it. All right, time to move on to facts and trivia. What are some other facts and trivia we can share with our audience about Purple Rain?
Well, Bill Bant, I mentioned early on that I always get Vanity and Apollonia confused. Well, here's a little behind-the-scenes trivia. Vanity was Prince's protege and was originally slated to be cast as the kid's love interest in Purple Rain. However, Vanity left the film prior to shooting, and the girl group Vanity 6 became Apollonia 6. Apollonia's role was initially offered to Jennifer Beals, who turned it down because she wanted to concentrate on college. And then eventually it goes to Apollonia Cotero, who was then virtually unknown. Prince had seen her in an appearance on the February 1983 episode of Tales of the Gold Monkey, in which she played a saucy island girl. There you go.
Yes. Loved all, 10 episodes of that show that aired?
You familiar with Tales of the Gold Monkey, Bill Bant?
Yeah. It was an Indiana Jones ripoff.
Oh.
I think the lead character was the dad from, was it Seventh Heaven?
Okay, sure.
Yeah. It got axed pretty quick.
Gotcha.
So in 2019, Purple Rain was selected to the Library of Congress for preservation in the United States National Film Registry for being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Good for you, Purple Rain.
Well done. During production, director Magnoli asked Prince to write one more song that touched on the themes of the film. The following day, Prince already had the song When Doves Cry fully produced. Jesus Christ. Are you kidding me?
I'm not surprised by that. I wish someone would actually put out a book of just Prince stories, because it seems like anyone of, I guess, entertainment significance always has a great Prince story. I'm like, these should all be put in print. Some of them are just hilarious.
Absolutely. I've heard on podcasts the story about him on the set of New Girl in 2014, just being a scamp, being a prankster, and a ton of fun.
That's the only episode of that show I watched, just because he was in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's great. I love Jake Johnson, who's on that show.
How did Purple Rain get made? So here's a little backstory here. So in 1982, when Prince was renegotiating his contract with his then managers, he'd only re-sign with them if they could get him a movie. And they agreed and matched his $500,000 investment to get the project rolling. So that's how it got started. You think about it, he's only 22, 23.
Yeah.
And he's not really a known commodity at that point. I mean, he had Parade. Wait, was it Parade or 1999? Album.
Right. Yeah.
That was the only, that was kind of the only mainstream one of the four.
But dang.
Good call.
Heck yeah. Did all right. 8 months before his death, Prince purchased the House of the Kid in Minneapolis, located on Snelling Avenue in the Longfellow community. it was used for exterior scenes in the movie. The house, which the Prince estate owns, is a popular tourist destination for fans of the film.
Oh, I didn't see that one. So the First Avenue Club that we see in the movie is an actual club in Minneapolis. The filmmakers paid $100,000 for the club to stay closed for 25 days. And it was supposed to stay closed from November 26th through December 20th of 1983. But luckily, production was able to get all the scenes filmed in just a little over a week.
Aha. Uh-huh. There you go. A few days before the premiere of Purple Rain, Prince had a nightmare that Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert despised the film, with Ebert ripping the film apart. Prince said, "I dreamed of those two guys on the TV reviewing the movie and that the fat guy was tearing me up." I'm not going to give away the actual review. I'll let...
We'll find out if that is the case or not. All right, that's all I got for facts and trivia.
In case you were wondering, because I was watching the movie, the audio from the three songs in the final concert, which included I Would Die for You, Baby I'm a Star, and the title song Purple Rain, were recorded live on August 3rd, 1983 at the First Avenue Club in Minneapolis as part of a fundraiser for the Minnesota Dance Theater. It also marked the official debut of Prince's new band, The Revolution. The concert scenes were reenacted later. So in this movie, the songs were pre-recorded, but Prince and The Revolution played live along with the tracks to capture the feel of a true live performance.
Good stuff. All right, moving on to box office. So Purple Rain was released on July 27th, 1984 in 917 theaters. On an estimated budget of $7 million, it grossed $68.4 million domestically. It debuted number one at the box office, but only held that spot for 1 week, as it would fall to Ghostbusters the following week, which was on its ninth week of release. The movie would stay in the top 10 for the next 11 weeks after that. Purple Rain would be the 10th highest grossing movie in the United States for 1984. Moving on to reviews. So when growing up in the 80s, we would watch At the Movies with Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert to hear their reviews and watch clips of upcoming movies. Their review of Purple Rain was unanimous. Two thumbs up. Gene thought the musical numbers worked very well dramatically and that there was a lot of fresh young talent in the movie. Roger thought it was the best rock film since Pink Floyd The Wall, and he was a fan of Apollonia. Both critics put Purple Rain in their end of the year 10 best list. That's how much they liked it. Rotten Tomatoes gives it a tomato meter score of 72% with an audience score of 78%. It also has an IMDb rating of 6.5. So this takes us to additional thoughts and questions. What are some additional thoughts and questions we have about Purple Rain?
Oh, man. What do we got? Well, this is something I was thinking about. We know that the kid is living at home at age 25. Not a huge deal unto itself. You know, live at home as long as you can, I guess. But how much money is he making, do you think, Bill Band? Is he making bank only performing at the First Avenue Club? Or can you really see Prince working a 9-to-5 somewhere for supplemental income?
That would be a big no.
In a cubicle, working a 9-to-5, hitting the club at night?
It kind of does make me think about it, because it's how many times do they perform a week?
Mm-hmm.
And they're always constantly drawing in the crowds because there's only three bands.
I mean, if he's living at home.
Yeah, because you got to split it up between, was it five others?
Yeah, good point. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I never thought about that.
Yeah. I was just going to say, if he's living at home, I don't know if his parents are charging him rent, but
right,
maybe he doesn't have that many expenses, but still.
Yeah, that's the place to be if you want to launch your career. Supposedly, I mean, that's what they allude to in the films. Like, if you mm-hmm. get there, if you're playing at First Avenue, you're probably going to go big.
Yeah. What do you have some questions, some thoughts?
Well, I know that in the beginning of the film, when we see Apollonia fill out the postcard, it says that she's 19 years old. That was, of course, not the case. I'm like, there's no way. I've never met a 19-year-old that looks like that. So just for the yeah. record, she was 25 at the time.
Yeah. Okay.
But just to show how big Prince was at the time this movie came out, and I can't believe we forgot to mention this is the 40th anniversary of this movie. That makes us kind of old. But Prince topped the box office, the album chart, and the singles chart all at the same time. That was like his pinnacle of the 80s right then.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I mean, this album, Purple Rain, spent 24 consecutive weeks atop the Billboard 200. It was present on that chart for a total of 167 weeks. When Doves Cry and Let's Go Crazy reached number one on the Billboard Hot 100, while Purple Rain peaked at number two, and I Would Die For You peaked at number eight. In May 1996, the album was certified 13 times platinum by the Recording Industry Association of America. Not bad, right? Yeah. I mean, that's pretty good. 13 times platinum. I was going to recommend to fans, Bill hit it on the head here. He said everyone who's ever met Prince or worked with him has a story, and they're great stories, great Prince stories, very entertaining. One of my favorite stories was just watching Jamie Foxx do his stand-up, and I wish I had more time to research the name of that particular stand-up, but in one of his shows, you can YouTube it. It's a segment basically called Don't Look Into His Eyes, and I don't know if you've seen this, Bill Bant, but it's hilarious, and it's about Jamie Foxx going either backstage or I don't know where it was, but he encounters a security guard before getting to Prince, and I believe it's the security guard or bouncer or someone who says to Jamie Foxx, whatever you do, don't look into his eyes. Jamie Foxx, and you have to understand Jamie Foxx doing so many different impersonations, and he's just, Jamie Foxx is one of those, again, just one of those all-around wonderful entertainers, musician and actor and just a talented dude. And he's so entertaining when he tells a story, and then he finally meets Prince and makes the ultimate mistake, of course, in looking into his eyes and basically like falling in love with him in a moment, in a split second, just looking in, and does his own Prince impersonation. I can't do it justice, so I'm not going to even try, but I would recommend looking it up. Jamie Foxx and the bit, Don't Look Into His Eyes.
Oh, that's hilarious. So, of course, I have to ask, because you're a Prince fan, you've already mentioned your favorite Prince song. So I'm assuming Purple Rain is your favorite album.
Absolutely.
Also. Okay.
It is. Yeah, that's the one I identify with most and have the strongest connection to.
Gotcha.
How about yourself, Bill Bant? Favorite song, album?
My favorite song, and this is kind of funny because it actually comes from the Batman soundtrack, and it's Scandalous. And it's a song that plays, it's the one that plays over the end credits. And
great call.
There was a girl when I finished school and worked at UM, and this girl was huge, 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 huge Prince fan. Like if you mentioned Prince in front, she would faint. That's how much she loved Prince. And she actually had a bootleg copy of the Black Album, which Prince was supposed to release in the 80s, and he pulled it last minute. And she gave me a copy of it. And then she gave me a copy of all these different renditions of Scandalous. And I still have it on cassette. So,
wow.
Yeah, there's a lot of, there's like six or seven different versions of it. And I can't find it anywhere else because I'm kind of like, damn, I have a cassette. And I want it digital or in CD and I can't find it. So I still have that one. But for my favorite Prince album, and this one's kind of out of the box because there's a story behind it. And it's actually 1988's Love Sexy, which there's a lot of controversy too, because it had a picture of Prince on the cover naked. And, you know, when they were selling the stores, they had to put like a black covering over it. And the reason it's my favorite one is because in the summer of 88, we were down the shore and we were at one of those booths with the wheels, and it had the numbers. And if you put a quarter on a number and you hit, they were giving away cassettes. My dad gave me $4 to play, and I actually hit twice. And I got Love Sexy from Prince, and I got Robert Palmer's Heavy Nova. Awesome. And Jason, to this day, I still have the Love Sexy cassette.
There it is. Ladies and gentlemen, you can't see it, of course, but Bill right now is holding up his cassette of Love Sexy to the camera. That's great, man.
And I remember being super excited, and we came back from the boardwalk, and I went to go show my grandmother. I'm like, look what I want on the boardwalk. And she was like, oh my God, that is so disgusting. Get that out of my face. So I will never forget that. I mean, Love Sexy is basically known just for Alphabet Street. That's really the big song on there. But all the other tunes I just find really catchy and it really works. But the weird thing is if you buy it on CD or digital, it's all technically one song. So anytime I put it in like my mix and it goes, it just plays the whole album. It doesn't cut up the songs at all. But it does have Glam Slam on there, which referred to as, like you said earlier in the show, about the name of the club in Graffiti Bridge.
Right.
But yeah, all these years later, still have my Love Sexy cassette.
You are Love Sexy. You're the embodiment of Love Sexy, Bill Bandt.
Thank you.
Great story. Thanks for sharing that. That's just great, man. It's funny and it's heartwarming. It's awesome. Glad you still have the cassette. I miss cassettes. And I had that Batman soundtrack. I had the Prince soundtrack. I had the Danny Elfman soundtrack. I love the movie, of course. But Scandalous, man, was my favorite song off of that by far. I listened to that a million times. I mean, ad nauseum. I listened to it all the time. I'd have it playing as I was falling asleep. I like imagined all these romantic scenarios as I was coming into my own at that age, listening to that song. It's just, man. Prince rules.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, When Doves Cry would be in my top five. You got the look from Sign of the Times. Oh, man, he's got some great ones. And well, you said you've seen them.
Little Red Corvette is still up there, too.
And I have to say, you know, I got to see him perform twice, and I was there for the Super Bowl when he got to perform at halftime, and that was freaking amazing. God.
Yeah.
And it was crazy, too, because there was rumors going around. That was actually my last year with the Dolphins. And there was rumors going around because of the rain that he was not going to perform. And I was like, I don't care about the game. I'm here because I wanted to see Prince perform.
Yeah.
And I was so pissed when I heard that. And then the rain kind of stopped like right at halftime. And then he came out and I think about two thirds of the way through, of course, when he's playing Purple Rain, the rain started again.
Yeah.
It was amazing. And, you know, most people say it is one of the best halftime performances of all time.
No surprise, right?
Yeah.
And like I said, when you see him live, he was the real deal.
And it was great because I was right there on the 50 in like the mid-level. So I wasn't even in the rain and just got to watch. And I was just like, this is awesome.
Yeah. It's a gift to be able to see him live.
Yeah, it was.
That's awesome. Great stuff, man. That's all I've got, man.
Yeah, because we could just go on and on about Prince himself.
Yeah, no doubt.
All right. So let's move on to our ratings. So here we go. On a scale of 1 to 5 doves, what do you give Purple Rain?
Man, after doing this podcast and just, I'm going to give this 4 doves. I'm giving it 4 doves. It's just great. I'm overwhelmed. I loved this film. It brought me back to the 80s. It made me smile. It made me cry on the inside. It made me want to listen to this whole album over and over and over and over again. It's just such a wonderful and incredible reminder of what a tour de force Prince was, still is to this day. He is one of one. There will never be another like him. Sure, the narrative of the film isn't, like when I'm talking about the straight narrative in between the music, isn't always successful. The acting is questionable in moments, like I mentioned, whatever. You know, I overlook that. I'm just going to overlook it. It's the music. It's the music. It's the music. It's the kid, Prince, and the Revolution's performances in this. They elevate the movie above whatever might be lacking. I was genuinely moved at the end. And we may have lost Prince too soon, but we'll always have this movie and his legacy with the numerous, numerous albums and songs and artistry he's left behind. I love the Purple Rain soundtrack. I now officially, if not before, love this movie. Look, Prince is huge and is part of 80s popular culture. He's such a huge part of the culture and shaped so many things. I mean, just with music and everything, I grew up with him. So there's an attachment. There's a connection that I adore and will always treasure. So 4 doves for me.
Yeah, I'm right there with you with the 4 doves. And the main reason is the music. Every time they were on stage to perform, I was just mesmerized all these years later. Makes you remember what a great artist he was. And what sucks is, too, is I really started getting back into his music again there at the end. I think I had bought his last 3 albums because, you know, there was a period where he was putting all this stuff out and no one was really listening to it. But then I started getting back into it and then just hearing it pass out. That was a blow. That really hit hard. So to have this immortalized on film, it's just amazing. And for the younger people who don't really know, maybe, you know, just heard the music but never really seen him perform, certainly check out this movie. And I really love the way it all tied into the film itself. Yeah, the narrative is so-so. I think I'm a little more forgiving on the acting than Jason is, but this is solid. It was a lot of fun. 40 years later, it still works for me big time.
Yeah, I totally agree. Kids, if you want to know what the 80s were about, this is a real slice of life from the 80s. It's a very 80s movie when it comes to all the style and dress, etc., the look. But again, it just comes down to the music.
Yeah, I'm glad I kind of missed the makeup in the club scene that kind of died out before we were old enough to go.
Right.
Some of that stuff, I'm like, oh, okay. That's kind of a little beyond me.
Yeah. Incredible. All right, man. That was awesome.
I think that about wraps it up for this week's episode. As always, thank you so much for listening. Please take the time to follow us on your preferred streaming platform, give us a review, and rate us. If you want to learn more about our show, you can visit us at all80smoviespodcast.com. For our next episode, we are discussing St. Elmo's Fire. It stars a bevy of actors that were given a moniker they would prefer to disassociate with. We will touch on that next week. We hope you can join us. Have an excellent week, everyone.
Bill Bandt, I only want to see you laughing in the purple rain. Thanks for staying up with us. Good night, world.